This is Public. This is a podcast about cities, people and place.
This is Emma Telfer.
And this is Sally McPhee.
I'm the Executive Director of Open House Melbourne.
And I collaborate on projects that engage people in culture, nature, art and place. We live in Melbourne, Australia,
and we love our city. We've been friends for years, but come from kind of different careers. But recently we've started working together on public programs about the city. We saw the opportunity for documenting, sharing and making more public the content and ideas of our work.
And these same projects also bring together thinkers, doers and advocates
who are shaping our city. To be public is to be shared. So this is us, sharing some of the stories, ideas and issues consuming our thoughts via a podcast. All made possible by the Metro Tunnel Creative Program. A program dedicated to enhancing city life alongside the construction of the Metro Tunnel.
Welcome to This is Public. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Sally.
This is it. Welcome to episode one of This is Public, titled Waterfront. We have been talking about making this podcast for years, so it's very exciting to be here in the studio.
Absolutely. How many years do you think it's been? Six? Eight?
Maybe three.
It feels like a long time.
It's very appropriate that we're recording this at the podcast studio bar at the ESPY, one of Melbourne's most cherished waterfront pubs, because for this first episode, we're taking a deep dive into the role design plays in reframing our relationship with urban waterways.
And one waterway in particular is a river flowing through Melbourne, the Yarra River, or Birrarung, as it's always been known to Melbourne's First Nations people. Do you think about the river in your city? Is it loved and cherished, or is it forgotten, ignored? How is its health? Would you swim in it? Do you see it as a vital part of city life?
Well, we have three great conversations to share with you about these very questions. All of our guests today collaborated with us as part of Waterfront, Open House Melbourne's special program for Melbourne Design Week 2019. For Waterfront, we took people out of auditoriums and away from PowerPoints and invited them to explore by boat, by bike, and by foot. We asked them to reimagine the river in real time.
In our first interview, we consider the whole river system with Dr. Melissa Neave from RMIT University and Andrew Kelly, the Yarra River Keeper, exploring the flow-on effects of past design decisions, current challenges, and possible futures for the river flowing through Melbourne.
Then Emma speaks to Paul Thomas from Rail Projects Victoria at the Metro Tunnel construction site on the banks of the river to talk about how the Metro Tunnel project navigates complex tunnelling under the Yarra.
And lastly, we head back to the ESPY to imagine a future of urban wild swimming with Michael O'Neill from Yarra Swim Co and Andre Benice from Wawawa Architecture. They share with us how the Yarra Pools proposal encourages connection and contact with the river.
But first up, Dr. Melissa Neave and Andrew Kelly open our minds to rivers as integrated living systems.
When you think about urban rivers, one of the most obvious things that happens is the urban river becomes disconnected from the landscape in which it flows. And that happens because we reinforce the banks, we build on the floodplain, we disconnect the floodplain from the groundwater, which feeds the river as well. We put dams on the river, which impound the flow, so we disconnect it from the upstream as well. And so what was an interconnected set of water particles in the landscape becomes this cut-off thread almost, which is the river in its channel. And so that disconnect that happens in urban environments, I think, is really at the crux of the loss of the value of rivers. I'm Melissa Neave, a lecturer at RMIT University. So my background is in geography, particularly river science. My PhD was in fluvial geomorphology, which is a big term for really saying it's the role of water as an agent of landscape change. And the biggest visible aspect of that is a river. But of course, I'm also just interested in rivers because they're such fascinating entities. They're beings, I think, in and of themselves. And so I live close to the Maribyrnong, and I am close to the water and have been close to rivers kind of all my life.
My name's Andrew Kelly. I'm the Yarra River Keeper. As the Yarra River Keeper, I'm the voice of the river. The river can't speak for itself. So the riverkeeper speaks for the river, reflects the community views on the river, and gives the community a voice about the river in terms of the whole river, from source at Mount Gregory to the bay. For me, I've grown up along the river. I grew up in South Yarra. I became riverkeeper in November 2014. I was on the committee before that, and I joined the association because I saw a photo of my predecessor Ian Penrose in the Good Weekend magazine zipping up the river in our old tinny. We now have a much more sophisticated boat. And I thought, oh, God, that looks fantastic. You know, I'd really think that's amazing. And I think it's such a great title. But I never imagined that some years later here I'd be with that very title and a bigger and better boat. So we see the river as integrated and one single living entity, which is actually the wording from the Yarra River Protection Willapkin Birrarung Maron Act, which was passed last September 2017. We lobbied for that act. Before the 2014 election under Ian Penrose, we went round and knocked on the doors of politicians of all sides, all colours, all stripes, and it was the ALP who took it up and promised a Yarra River Protection Act and a Yarra Trust. The Yarra Trust has become the Birrarung Council, and we now have a Yarra Act. So that's kind of what we do. So we're speaking to government on behalf of the community about their waterway.
It would be great, actually, if you both would like to speak about the Yarra River Protection Act and how it is different to previous approaches to legislation. What do you envisage to be the tangible and visible implications of the new or relatively new Act?
My understanding of the Act is very much that it's about giving the river authority and voice and recognition autonomy. One of the things that I very much like about it, and we're seeing similar kinds of legislation come out in other places around the world or policy, is the fact that the river is treated as a being almost. It's not just a thread of water across the landscape. It's an entity that shifts and changes with conditions and reflects conditions in the catchment in which it flows. And I think this is a really exciting opportunity for us to appreciate that dimension of rivers.
The Act really deals more in a sense with the banks and the bed than it does with the water that flows through the river. Well, that's obviously a critical path. But if you look at the Whanganui in New Zealand, which has achieved legal personhood, it is based on the Maori concept of really the river being a god and being one integrated god, that you don't distinguish between the banks and the water and the bed. You see it as one thing because they're all interdependent and probably the groundwater, as Mel suggests, as well. And the Act is also about caring for country and caring for country in an urban context. So the name of the Act is the Yarra River Protection Willapkin Birrarung Maron Act. And Willapkin Birrarung Maron are the Woiwurrung words meaning keep the Birrarung alive. And then in the preamble is both in Woiwurrung and in English. And that's the first time that's been done in the state. So that's really significant because I think it's kind of reconceptualizing the way we look at natural ecosystems. We are, I think, testing out new models with the Yarra River Protection Act. It's still early days with it and who quite know how is it going to work out, but it is demanding a lot more cooperation between the agencies involved, which include local councils, Melbourne Water, Parks Victoria, Vic Roads, a whole lot of agencies now have to come together and agree on a long-term plan for the river.
We talk about a river like any urban river probably, but definitely the Yarra, the word pollution comes up a lot. Some people might assume when we talk about pollution that we're talking about something that's being pumped directly into the river. And certainly this was the case in Melbourne. We've heard a re-emergence of the old Smelbourne jokes throughout the waterfront program. But I've heard you both in the past talk about, in regards to the Yarra specifically, that it's much more than that. It's much more than what we knowingly put into it. Can you talk a bit about what the kind of modern day version of pollution is, especially in regards to Birrarung?
In general, we identify two kinds of pollution in a very crude sense, which is point source and non-point source. And so the point source is the old style you know, where we're directly discharging into the channel. So what we're dealing mostly with is what we call non-point source or diffuse pollutants. And these are pollutants that come from the everyday activities that take place within the catchment. And because our catchment has, up in the headwaters, it has those amazing pristine environments, but then it's got agricultural landscapes, and the agricultural landscapes are producing, using agrochemicals in their activities. Those materials come through the water, both over the land, but also through the groundwater into the channel, and then come downstream. And then you've got urban centres that have rubbish, so a lot of litter, but plastic litter in particular, rubbish that floats off the surface, oils, petroleum products, things like that, that are on the surfaces and brought in. And then still further down, we still do have industrial inputs into the system. But then we also have the history, which is the soil, I guess, the history of the use of the catchment since colonisation, which has led to materials that are still in the soil that also get mobilised through erosion events and then transported in. And so the soil itself can be considered a pollutant. And some of the initiatives around reclaiming rivers and renaturalising rivers are really stymied by the fact that the soils on the channels can be really very polluted.
Most people don't realise that whatever you drop on the roads gets washed into the stormwater system, that gets washed into the creek, and the creek washes into the river. And of course, at the end of the Yarra, that's really the concentration of everything that's been dropped in the catchment. So the biggest threat happens really on the edges of the Yarra catchment, the new developments that are going in, the hard surfacing, the roads, the car parks, the outdoor rooms, all of these sorts of things that are being put in mean that all the rubbish that gets dropped on the road, the remains of our disc brakes, because the disc brakes work by wearing away, the remains of our tyres, because they also work by wearing away, really. That's how they stop. So they contain a lot of things like copper, a lot of heavy metals, and so that falls on the road along with the hydrocarbons that Mel mentioned, and they get washed into the river. And those pollutants kill off a lot of the microscopic stuff that lives in the river, which means that there's nothing then for the next stage up, the macroinvertebrates, to feed on. So you get less and less diversity in the river. There's less for the fish to feed on, and there's a lot of fish in the Yarra at the moment. You know, you see lots of cormorants on the river, and there's lots of cormorants on the river because there's lots of fish in the river, but we'll lose that.
Is it unique to Melbourne that we have unfiltered stormwater just flowing straight into the Yarra or still into our waterways? Or is this a common occurrence around the world? What could be the role of design in assisting us in solving some of these big challenges? Because it seems like an easy win, to a layman anyway, or a laywoman, that you could at least start to filter some of this that's going straight in. Are there, you know, global examples that we could be looking to?
Stormwater is actually tricky to manage because it's so ephemeral in nature. And so you've got these periods in which there's lots of stormwater, but it's coming from really disparate regions in the catchment. So to design a stormwater catchment system, it has to be big enough to withstand these big flow events, and it has to be able to process the water fast enough so that it doesn't overwhelm the system during the high flow events. And so one of the reasons there tends to be untreated stormwater is just because it's just easier than having to design a structure where you're channeling the water and dealing with it. So, I mean, there are examples of very poorly designed stormwater management systems. A number of cities around the world that have connected stormwater sewage systems. So the stormwater's coming in to the sewage system and getting treated, which sounds good, except in high flow events.
One solution is sort of rain gardens. I don't know, in terms of design and how do we make these rain gardens work, they're a design challenge. If you look at New York, they've spent $2 billion on putting in rain gardens as a solution to stormwater. Chicago's gone the opposite route and combined their stormwater and their sewage system, and they have an immense pipes and immense holding tanks to deal with the sewage from the city. We're at the Yarra River Keepers very interested at the moment in the concept of rewilding or wilding, which in the context of Australia with 60,000 years of Indigenous Australian or Aboriginal Australian occupation is not quite the word you want to use. But it's really about how we look after the river, and the rewilding concept is very much about cause and connection. So it's looking at how can we build big chunks of relatively natural areas where natural ecosystems support each other, and there's resilience built in, which we're going to need in a drying climate, which are then connected by corridors so that you can have those migrations that Mel mentioned going upstream, downstream, and also daily migrations into the catchment and back to the water.
We had a conversation called Cultural Flows as part of the Waterfront program and spoke about exactly the point you made with rewilding. We were throwing around ideas yesterday about what would the term be, you know, and it's actually just living in harmony, isn't it, with your natural resources.
It's a really interesting idea. The distinction that we were sort of heading towards was about living in the landscape rather than living on the landscape. So I think we live on the landscape, and it's a different experience to be living in the landscape, and manipulating is the wrong sort of word, but manipulating natural processes to drive outcomes that usually lead to greater biodiversity, with the way that Indigenous Australians manage the landscape. I have just finished reading Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu for the second time round, and that is kind of transformative at the way we look at our landscape, I think.
You mentioned, Mel, on the boat on Sunday, the idea that we need to reconcile the fact that we can never go completely back, but actually how do we improve the situation to a point which is acceptable? And I thought that was a really interesting point.
Yeah, well, when you look at the literature about river restoration, river rehabilitation, river naturalisation, the term that first was used was river restoration, which implies, you know, a return to some past form. That language, I mean, it's impossible to achieve that. We've affected the landscape. Even if we removed ourselves, our impacts would still be felt in the landscape. So we've moved away from the language of restoration to either rehabilitation or naturalisation, which has become a better term really in many senses, which is just implying that rivers are able to do things themselves. We don't need to be engaging with them in the way that we often do. And so there's been a lot of movements in various places around the world to try and recover urban rivers into a better condition and a more natural condition, and then to provide those benefits, those recreational, social, environmental benefits, as well as not having flooding, you know, not having the negative impacts of flooding or mosquitoes or, you know, poor water quality and so forth, having a healthy system, but a system that has additional benefits to just being a drain, which is what they really were often treated like.
But thank you so much. It's been a really fantastic conversation. The question is two parts. So it is around what you see as the biggest threat or challenge to our urban waterways as our city is scaling up at an enormous rate, but then also what is your hope for the future of our waterways?
Biggest threat is stormwater. Next biggest threat is loss of open space. And my vision for the river is going back to the concept of rewilding as created by Dave Foreman, where he talked about cores and corridors. So I would love to see the river being further developed, because we do have cores and we do have corridors, but let's kind of really stitch it together into a really effective and beautiful and world-class example of how we can build a self-sustaining river and river corridor that has biodiversity cores and connectivity for daily, weekly, monthly, seasonal and multi-year migrations by natural species, so they have the maximum chance, the maximum amount of resilience that we can build into it.
I agree. I think the biggest threat, of course, is people and our ongoing desire to get as close to the river as we can in a way, which sounds like a good thing until you're talking about actual that translating into people living right on the river and what should be public land becoming private space, and that balance between the public-private, I think, is a serious threat. And I completely agree. What I would absolutely love to see for the river is an entire network along the whole system that is interconnected and, you know, up right up the Boorong, all the way up, would be just imagine being able to walk all that length as the First Peoples were able to do. It'd just be fantastic.
That was Dr. Melissa Neave from RMIT University's Global Urban and Social Studies School, and Andrew Kelly, the Yarra Riverkeeper. You can find out more about their important work at openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic.
Construction has begun on the Metro Tunnel in Melbourne, where tunnel boring machines, or TBMs, will help tunnel 9 kilometres of twin rail tunnels beneath our feet. That means crossing under the Yarra, navigating changeable geological conditions, as well as the water itself.
Emma visited Paul Thomas, Deputy Director for Tunnels and Underground Stations for Rail Projects Victoria, on site to hear how this big infrastructure project respects the river.
So we're now standing looking at St Paul's Cathedral and Flinders Street Station and Princes Bridge, which are across the river, and the significance of St Paul's Cathedral and Flinders Street in particular, and the Young and Jackson's pub, is where CBD South, or Town Hall Station as we know it now, is located, and where the TBM tunnel boring machines will eventually tunnel into the CBD South station. So my name's Paul Thomas. I'm currently the Deputy Director for Tunnels and Underground Stations for Rail Project Victoria, and I look after the Metro Tunnel project. I'm originally from South Wales. I studied civil engineering there, and I'm a chartered engineer and a chartered manager. And I've spent nearly 30 years working on tunnelling and underground projects. Melbourne Metro is my 7th metro project. Those previous ones were in Singapore, Hong Kong, Riyadh and New Delhi. So we have 2 critical portal structures, the West and the East Portal, which is where the underground works actually start from. So we have 4 tunnel boring machines on this project. These machines are what we call slurry McShield machines. I've used them before on projects in Singapore in particular, and also in Hong Kong. We've got what is called a backup system. The backup system is best described as steelwork, like a train that is pulled behind the TBM, and that accommodates, for instance, welfare facilities. So there's canteens, there's a toilet there, there's a refuge chamber. It also accommodates all the support services that are required for the TBM to operate. And at any given time, you've probably got about 14 people down in the tunnel, which includes your operator, it includes your ring erectors, putting the segments up, the guys doing the grouting, electricians, mechanics, and engineers. So that's the kind of numbers you're looking at. We've spent a lot of time and continue to spend more time fixing the alignment and making sure that the alignment responds to a couple of key significant features. One is, of course, is the existing structures, which includes the Princes Bridge and St Paul's Cathedral and Flinders Street, but also the geological conditions and, of course, the influence of the river upon our tunnelling. The geological conditions under the Princes Bridge are the most challenging, they're the most complex and most variable. There's about 550, 600 metres of complex tunnelling that we have to deal with under the Princes Bridge. We encounter very soft soil conditions, very soft ground conditions, aquifer systems. We also encounter some harder rock material in terms of the basalt and the Melbourne formation. So that means within about 550 metres and 600 metres of Town Hall Station and the Princes Bridge, that we will get 6 or 7 critical geological interface zones which we have to contend with.
Are there conditions unique to a tunnelling under the Yarra or Boorong which are quite different to other examples that you've worked across? Or are there similarities that you're finding?
So there's lots of similarities, albeit structurally, geologically different, but the principle is the same. It's about having the best means and methods of tunnelling to be able to respond to ever-changing environments, whether it's climatic, whether it's geological, and whether it's construction related. In Singapore, for instance, we had to contend with a main canal. We couldn't have any construction groundwater discharged to the canal. That was a very, very important point that we didn't want to contaminate, and rightly so. Otherwise, those contaminants, such as concrete, bentonite mud, and general construction water, would end up in the bay in Singapore, which is a big no-no. But also we were tunnelling directly underneath the canal. So for instance, compared to the Yarra River, the width of the canal was probably half the width of the Yarra River, But during storm events, this was full and carried a hell of a lot of water. And that means we had to make sure that during our tunneling, we knew what water was going through the canal. Because as we tunnel in underneath there, we got to make sure that we got the right balance of pressure to respond to the water and the potential flooding that's going on above. So as we're speaking here today, the first pile is actually going into the ground at the Young and Jackson site. This is a very important milestone for us because these piling works are quite deep and they are adjacent to the Yarra River. So this means we can now start to check quite thoroughly and reinforce our hydraulic analysis in terms of how the groundwater actually behave in the vicinity as we start to drill piles very deep into the ground and adjacent to the Yarra River. So what we are very, very conscious of is that we don't want any pollution getting into the rivers. So no matter where we are in the world, we don't dispose of construction water into river systems or any systems without any due care and attention. So one of my previous projects, for example, here in Australia, was the Bolgon Hydro Project. That involved 8 kilometres of tunnelling through the pristine national park in Bolgon. And we were next to Lake Guy, and we had a very deep basement for the power station, no different to what we're doing here now at behind Young and Jackson's, and we were below the river. So very important for us was obviously if the river flooded, it would flood our work, so we had flood control measures in place. But critically, our tunneling operations and our construction operations generated a lot of water. We use water in tunnel. We have to pump the water somewhere, and we have to dispose of it. And there are no sewerage systems in Bolgon we could deposit the water to. We had no choice other than to dispose it to Lake Guy. But this meant that we had to employ, obviously, very high-tech, very sophisticated water treatment plants, which made sure that the water being discharged was free of pollutants and contaminants. So we'll have similar controls here with the Yarra River. We're not discharging any construction water to the Yarra River. It's being disposed of through the sewer systems primarily, but more importantly, it gets treated on site so that we have water treatment plants on site that deal locally with the water and treat the water. This means balancing the pH, removing some of the sediments, etc., from there, and some of the oils and the greases that occur. So that means that the water is treated as thoroughly as possible before it's discharged anywhere.
What happens to the tunnel boring machines once they've completed their part of the project?
So basically what happens is that the main shield itself, which is like a tin can, which is about 12 to 30 metres long, about 75 mil to 100 mil plus thick of steel, is actually left in the ground, and that will then be encased in the concrete lining. So it becomes part of the tunnel, so to speak. The internal parts of the machine are then recovered, and these are brought back, in this particular case, back to Anzac Station. And normally what happens is some of the main components are actually recovered by the TBM supplier, and they reuse these parts so they can be used on future tunnel boring machines for future projects.
Now, I've heard that there's a tradition of praying to a saint. Can you tell me about that?
St. Barbara is the patron saint of miners and tunnelers, but St. Barbara goes back much, much further than that, where St. Barbara was associated with arms and gunnery, and it's transpired over the years that St. Barbara now represents the patron saints of tunnelers and miners, and generally underground work because of the historic relationship that's occurred. Nowadays, that most tunneling projects, most underground projects, do have a St. Barbara on site, which is placed in a prominent position, generally above the tunnels, so that St. Barbara then obviously safeguards, looks after, and makes sure that people that go underground to work come out safe at the end of the day. But of course, we have very good safety management and safety control measures these days that ensure that also. The St. Barbara travels and is kept by particular tunnelling crew, so it goes from project to project. So for instance, the St. Barbara we had on Bolgon ended up in Singapore and then went from Singapore to another project because it was the same tunnelling crews.
It's that's really beautiful, the idea that there's the saint overlooking and ensuring safety.
It's absolutely very, very important. And, you know, that's given the same respect, of course, as we respect the rivers and the other environments that we have to take care of during the course of the works.
That was Paul Thomas, Deputy Director for Tunnels and Underground Stations for Rail Projects Victoria. If you like geeking out on TBMs as much as we do, head to openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic to find out more.
From tunnelling under to diving in. For a few years now, community action group Yarra Swimco have been steadfastly advocating for a public swimming pool by the river. Michael O'Neill of Yarra Swimco and Andre Benice, Director of Wawawa Architecture, joined us at the ESPY to talk about returning swimming to the Yarra.
For me, it was really coming to, through Shane Gould's work and getting to meet her and read her thesis about the importance of outdoor swimming pools in Tasmania and understand really the role of swimming pools in Australian culture and that they're a meeting place. And they're not just a place to go and swim laps or to go and get fit or to go and throw school kids in and, you know, force them to swim up and down, which is my recollection of swimming at school in Queensland. And then you move to a place like Melbourne and you challenge your assumptions around what a beach is, around what swimming is, around what a river looks like. And then you start falling in love with the place and the landscape and you toughen up to the weather and you see how tough Victorians and Melburnians are to their environment and how they're always out in it and doing things. And you think about, you know, how great the laneways are and that people will sit next to a garbage bin on a milk crate paying $5 for a coffee while someone smokes all over them. And thousands of people would do that. So why wouldn't they go and sit next to their river? Why wouldn't they go and swim in their river? Of course they will. Of course they will do those things. Where's the opportunity to do that? I'm Michael O'Neill, the president of the Yarra Swim Co. The project's been around for about 5 years and it originally started with a group of people who wanted to see the return of the 3-mile swimming race, which used to run from McRobertson Bridge or the Twickenham Ferry at the time down to Prince's Bridge in the city. And that was one of our co-founders, Matt Stewart, and a group of his friends who got together who wanted to do that. So that's a long-term vision, is to bring that race back, to have a river that is swimmable enough to do that, but also a river that is swimmable enough to do that on any day of the week at any time people want to get in. So the pool becomes a stopgap measure or the way of exploring that and getting people down to the riverbank and bring back that possibility around a fully swimmable river.
I'm Andre Benice, Director of Wawawa. So it was a couple of years ago now, but as an office, we'd actually, working with a mayor candidate for the city of Port Phillip, actually designed a pool for Port Melbourne. And that was part of their election campaign. They didn't get up and the pool didn't get up either. But off the back of that work, we got in touch, or Michael got in touch with us and Yarra Pools to sort of see if we'd be interested in working on the Yarra Pools project more specifically. And so that's where it really started. And I think, when we sort of met with Michael and the other members of Yarra Pools, we were really invigorated to totally invest in the project. So I think the interesting thing for us on this project was actually that the architecture doesn't really come first. That's a sort of secondary concern. And so those issues about replenishing the environment that's there sort of were really kind of paramount. That was sort of paired with the cultural importance of the particular site. And so that just became a really sort of stimulating project to work within and sort of an important one for us, starting to establish ourselves and what we find important for the city and for build projects in Melbourne.
And this is not the first version of the Yarra Pools concept. There's been an earlier version released maybe 2 years ago, would that be right?
Yeah, with the pool exhibition at the Venice Biennale part of that.
So if you could talk about the main differences between the initial initiative that was released and the Wawawa approach.
Yeah, so I think the original design by Studio Octopi was, you know, what they term a render drop, really, and it was about starting a discussion and getting people to get excited about this idea. Post that, we went back and had a think about the wider design issues. And I'm very passionate about Melbourne and having Melbourne designers involved. That wasn't didn't involve a Melbourne designer. It was a London-based architect. And we're very thankful for them. And that introduction actually came through the Yarra Riverkeeper.
So the original pool design was a really sort of detached, self-contained pool that sort of wasn't really dealing with the site in too much of a complicated way. It, for us, started with running a design studio at RMIT University in conjunction with the NGV. And that allowed us to sort of do a lot of research with the students into the culture of swimming and also the history of the Yarra and the culture of the city with the river itself. And, you know, that was a really good sort of foundation. A really important moment was doing a cultural walk with Dean Stewart. A few of us had a bit of understanding of the history and importance of that particular site, Enterprise Park, but doing that and experiencing that with Dean was a sort of really profound moment. I think a big shift in the two approaches. We had this walk with Dean, we sort of understood the legacy of this site and how important it had been for thousands of years, particularly for the Kulin Nation. And it was a spot where people would meet and gather and had been for thousands of years. And it had this, you know, long and lasting legacy well before, you know, the Enterprise arrived there at the dock. That's when the real shift came and more of a drive to emphasise transforming that site.
This is a good time to talk about the site itself and the decision to link the pool directly to Enterprise Park. It seems like it's been a great strategy in one sense, but at the same time slightly challenging. So why Enterprise Park, and can you just talk about that?
So the main reason for the pool to be located there is that there's a ready-made cutout that is waiting for a pool or something to be dropped into it, and that's the recreation of the turning basin that is where, you know, was a natural swimming location and then was the point that was dug out even further so that boats could turn around and get back out. That is out of the main stem of the river, and we don't annoy existing Yarra River users. You know, it wasn't my first choice. It is such a challenging spot. It has, you know, 8 train lines running above it. It's got the aquarium. We've got low bridges, poor connectivity. There's traffic slip lanes. It's very close to, you know, the CBD, but really hard to get to. People find it unsafe at night, really unsafe, and most people don't even know where it is. And then you start unstitching the history and looking at the layers of it. So it is the founding point of Melbourne. It's the point of first contact. It's the point where everything changed for the Wurundjeri and the Boonwurrung people and all Aboriginal Victorians, actually. Our HODL grid is orientated off it. It's the site of one of the surprising things which I'd never thought I'd get in the feedback survey was, where's the agricultural reference? This is where the sheep first came aboard. This is where Victoria's agricultural sector started. And prior to that, people used to swim there. It was a natural pool and it was the meeting place of the fresh and the salt water. So it just becomes this kind of no-brainer, really.
Yeah, and I think for the success of the project as well, like it did need to be grounded somewhere, so it didn't just get pushed further downstream. So I think, you know, the opportunity to sort of really focus in on one particular area meant that people could more easily read it and understand it in that particular place. I think another important part was flipping the normal process in the CBD to sort of start with heavy infrastructure and buildings and to really let the landscape drive the design and allow the architecture or the uses to sort of emerge from that landscape. And, you know, because it is a mostly open site at the moment, there is that capacity.
This particular, the Yarra Pools proposal, isn't a traditional form of development where someone owns the land or leases the land already and then builds a pool because they want to or a local council wants to. It's what you've referred to as a citizen-led project. And can you talk a bit about that, about why it's a citizen-led project, how citizen-led projects kind of work and why they're important?
So we're trying to prove that this model can work and that if any city in the world where it can work, it should work in a place like Melbourne. So we should be receptive to ideas. Our city leaders are always looking for bold and transformational ideas. They put the call out, but then it's how do you navigate through those processes? How do you build it from the bottom up without a minister being able to say, I just love this, or it's my idea, I'm going to build it and make it happen and push it down through their department and get it approved and happening. So that's the difference with a citizen-led project. Melbourne, particularly in an Australian context, is much better place than any other city to be able to do this. You know, that's my view. And I think we should be able to deliver a lot more citizen-led projects at a scale like this. as opposed to just having things land out of the sky.
I wish there was a handbook that you could kind of follow, and I think we've sort of been working it out. I mean, we're, as an office, always trying to scheme for how we can get certain projects up and over the line. And that's been the challenging part of it, but also, you know, the fun part of it as well. I mean, we've just been basically trying everything we can. And I think it's, you know, really been about generating as much momentum as we can, creating as much discussion in the public so that it does sort of slowly grow. And I think, you know, culturally in the city, you can tell the people are really sort of shifting their opinion of the Yarra, and it's not something we should be afraid of. It's not to treat it like a bit of infrastructure, and that's, you know, a key resource that we should be really maintaining.
You did an enormous amount of community consultation throughout the last few years. What came out through that consultation process that perhaps surprised you? Was there something that challenged your assumptions about what people wanted from a pool? With you, Andre, was there something particular that you actually had to synthesize into the design that was really important to people?
Well, I think the first one that was definitely the most surprising, I think it came out out of one of the public forum discussions at M Pavilion, was the kayak drop-off point, which is obviously now sort of fundamental part. And I think the idea of using the Yarra as a sort of commuter river where you could arrive with your kayak for work, I definitely hadn't thought of, but then became a really crucial part to think about and incorporate. So I probably underestimated that it could serve all these other functions as well beyond just the sort of idea of a lap swimming pool. And the sort of huge extensive work that Michael had done with all those different stakeholders meant that there was plenty to choose from to sort of incorporate into the design and into the brief that sort of evolved.
The design has, for want of a better term, a sort of rewilded river edge where plants are kind of heavily incorporated. Are they functional? Are they aesthetic?
A bit of both. I think obviously the sort of core ambition of Yarra Pools is to make the Yarra swimmable. So, little by little. So it basically is setting up a mini wetlands that is a natural filtration system for the Yarra. Obviously the amount that's at Enterprise Park in the scheme wouldn't be enough to fully fill to the river, but I think it's an important message, and it sort of starts the job. It's a really important gesture to soften that edge, to sort of allow the river back into the city and to sort of stop barricading ourselves from it.
It seems like it's a common question that comes up every time, and it did on the boat. Will it be Yarra River water in the pool? People are quite nervous about that, but, it's interesting to hear that that's an important part of the strategy is, you know, actually kind of bringing people and the river together where you might actually have to start touching it and thinking about it.
Well, in the scheme as it is, I mean, the 50-metre pool, it would be separated from the Yarra, obviously, because it's sort of not near being clean enough, but there are parts where we've sort of left it open that ultimately they will become swimmable sections. So I think, you know, it's inviting that opportunity to occur, but importantly for the short term, we've still got a really usable clean section of water that we want to maintain as brown though. Keep the water brown, even if it is chlorinated.
You know, the key to that is we're pushing regulators. So in Victoria, our regulators aren't ready to approve something like this that would be filtered Yarra River water. So we've had those discussions. So we're very aspirational, but we're not idiots either. And I think the other thing is, and that goes into talking about the design of the site as well. It's not, we haven't come along and said, right, knock down the aquarium, tear down the train lines. You know, Wawawa have designed around all those site constraints and thought about how do you, you know, incorporate them and bring them in. How do you embrace them if you can? How do you say this is an urban environment, but how do you put some of the more natural elements in there? And I think as well, staying true to ourselves, we knew we had to rewild, for want of a better phrase, that edge. Because we said if we're putting something in the river, it still has to be beneficial to the river. So, you know, quite an extensive wetland palette and planting in an estuarine environment would, you know, if we can just improve the health by 1% or 2%, then, you know, that's worth doing, and that'd be a signal for the rest of the river's edge in that very built-up, hard edge of the city to start softening some of those places where the opportunities arise.
Well, what does success look like in the sense of what does a swimmable river look like, and how far away are we at the moment in terms of the health of the river now to what needs to improve for us to be swimming? If we remove the fact that you're not allowed to swim in an urban area of the Yarra at this point due to boat traffic and other issues. But if we're just talking about river health, what needs to change and what steps would we need to go through to make that happen?
Yeah, so there's been 3 decades of really hard work to get the Yarra to the point where it is. So removing sewage overflows, stopping large industry extracting and putting polluted water back into the rivers. We've tackled septic tanks, sort of, and land use issues upstream with agriculture. So the last bit, and those problems are still there and need to be continually worked on, but the last bit is really around stormwater management and how we do that. And that is really, delivered through wide-scale water-sensitive urban design and green investment in green infrastructure. And that's about urban form and urban planning, really. So someone said once, and someone will know who said this, but all our problems are land use problems. And if we can address that land use issue, then we drive the improvements in water quality in the river.
Are there cities that you're looking to for inspiration? Cities that are doing this well, bringing people back into their urban waterways and encouraging swimming and interaction?
Copenhagen's been a big inspiration. So they built one pool in their harbour and they used swimmability as the driver to clean up their sewage and stormwater system. And now they have 4 other pools in the region. The other place that I really like is Austin in the state of Texas. And they've got Barton Springs, which is a natural spring pool, which is central to that city's identity. But they also had the Deep Eddy Pool, which is a spring-fed pool. So from a regulation point of view, they fill that up. It's right next to their river. They fill it up with groundwater in the morning. They leave that in there for a day. No chlorination. Hundreds of people go in there and swim in it. It's fine.
Yeah, and I think that's, what makes it slightly frustrating at the same time, because there are all these sort of great examples of how you can do it. But I do think the sort of Yarra River does have its own unique traits as well, and there's a way to do it that's really local and specific to Melbourne. And I think that's been like a really important part with Andrew, the riverkeeper, and understanding that history of the site. And so a way to sort of do the same thing as other cities, but in a really, really Melbourne way.
Yeah, and I think, look, the Port Phillip Bay example, we're in St Kilda. You look out across across here and you can see the St Kilda sea baths, which do extract water from Port Phillip Bay and then chlorinate it up to a pool environment. And then Parramatta in Sydney are very much looking to turn their river swimmable again. And that's a social equity driver there. That's saying people in the eastern beaches and the eastern suburbs can go and access Bondi and Bronte and all these beautiful places. Why can't the 2 million people in the west of the city do the same thing? And the Parramatta River and the Yarra River have both been worked as hard as you could work a river post-colonial time. So if they can do it in Parramatta, if they can do it in Sydney, we should certainly be able to do it here, and we should do it before them. And I'll leave you with that thought.
A very big thank you to all of the guests on this, our very first episode. To find out more about Waterfront and the projects discussed today, head to openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic.
Ultimately, we want you to be more engaged, take action, demand better outcomes, pay attention. The recent news that Apple is pulling out of their Federation Square plans is a great example of how engaged citizens can create change and demand better outcomes for their city.
Urban rivers and water sources are under pressure across the world, despite the vital ecological, cultural, spiritual, and recreational value they offer. And Birrarung, the Yarra, is certainly one of them. You've been listening to Waterfront, the very first episode of This Is Public, a podcast series produced by Open House Melbourne.
We're an independent organisation that fosters public appreciation for architecture and public engagement in conversations about the future of our cities.
This Is Public episodes will be released every 2 months, give or take. Learn more, including where and how to listen, at openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic.
A deep thank you to presenting partner Metro Tunnel Creative Programme and supporting partner the SB, who have brought This Is Public to life, and to Open House Melbourne's generous donors, partners and supporters.
This Is Public is hosted and produced by us, Emma Telfer and Sally McPhee, with support from Brianna Carroll and Victoria Bennett. Our music and sound design is by Dan West, and our audio editor is Chris Andrews.
We record at the SB Podcast Bar, Tweak and Twang Studio, Number Station Studios and on location.
This Is Public is created on the ancestral lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to Elders past, present and emerging.
Thanks for listening.